support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. How could $500 a month change your life? Few strings attached, mostly just an extra deposit in your bank account. That was the driving question for organizers of a recent guaranteed basic income pilot program in King County. Through 10 months last year, the program provided $500 monthly payments to more than 100 county residents. And researchers and officials were curious, how would people use that money? And what could this small sample size tell us about the potential for bigger basic income programs? Organizers just published their results, and we've got KUW labor and economy reporter Monica Nicholsberg here to break them down. Hi, Monica. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, the program was based here in King County. Who organized the pilot?
Yeah, so it was organized by the Workforce Development Council of Seattle-King County, which is a nonprofit, but it got funding from the county and from the state, as well as from Chase Bank, from their nonprofit arm.
And you were able to talk to one of the participants in this guaranteed basic income pilot. Who did you speak with, and how did that extra $500 a month change things for them?
Yeah, I talked to this student named Rico Niamangera, and he is studying computer science at North Seattle College. He told me that the cash allowed him to stop working multiple jobs to pay for school. He's one of 8 children, and so he wasn't able to get support from his family. And as a result, his grades improved. He started paying off credit cards. And kind of big picture, he said that it really changed his outlook.
I am unemployed, which I guess would sound like a negative thing to most people. But for a student, that's the best place you can be. I've been able to focus solely on my academics. And first thing I did was start paying off my my credit cards. And that there alone, like not having to pay late payments or to just pay the bare minimum, was huge, because then I didn't have to worry so much about paying the bare minimum. I could start actually planning for tomorrow.
Yeah, so for Rico, he could better invest in his future, focus on school as grades went up, as you mentioned. How did he qualify for the program or even find out about it? Were there any parameters to join?
So the organizers of the program worked with a variety of nonprofits and community organizations to identify folks who would participate. They were looking at people who were affected by poverty, both working adults, some people experiencing homelessness, and some students who are low income.
Okay, so it's interesting to hear about Rico's specific experience, but what about more broadly, Monica? What kinds of impacts did this study find that the payments had on folks, the 102 people who benefited from them?
The biggest one was on employment. So the employment rates of participants jumped from 37% to 66%, almost double by the end of the program. Beyond that, the people who were working saw their pay increase. More people were able to pay bills on time and save money, especially the participants who had kids. Almost all of the participants who had kids were able to start saving.
Okay, I gotta ask, because it's sort of counterintuitive. Why would employment go up with this extra money? Personally, if I had a big influx of cash every month, I would start to kind of think about ways that I could work less. What are some reasons that employment would increase with the influx of money?
Yeah, I think that's a common misconception about these kinds of programs. But really what we see broadly with universal basic income pilots is that it just adds a little bit of slack for people who really have none in their lives. So if you think about having not enough money to make it through the day and cover your basic expenses, if there's an emergency, like your car breaking down or like a health event, you just don't have any money to cover that. That's where this $500 could go. And say fixing your car could allow you to get to job interviews, or you could afford part-time childcare. There are just a lot of scenarios where creating that little bit of cushion allows people to focus on their bigger picture goals.
Yeah, it adds like a stable platform from which you can operate. And when you're not in such a vulnerable and volatile situation, a lot of good things can come from that. What were the long-term goals of this pilot, Monica? I mean, how did the Workforce Development Council define success? And did they hit the target with this one?
So the main goal was to really study the impact of guaranteed basic income programs on poverty. And from their perspective, the pilot showed that it did have a real impact. That employment number was big for them, savings. There were also, you know, health outcomes and other improvements in people's lives that, taken together, the organizers of this program say this was a win.
Okay, so we've been talking about a lot of positive things here about, you know, Rico, the person who you spoke with who actually benefited from the extra $500 a month. What about opposition to UBI? I mean, this is not a universally beloved idea across the political spectrum. Monica, what kinds of opposition have you heard to the idea of implementing a guaranteed basic income on a wider scale?
Yes, to be sure, there is a lot of opposition to these types of programs. We talked to Paul Guppy, the vice president of research at the Washington Policy Center, which is a think tank here in the area. And he said that this program just encourages people to be dependent on the government without really addressing the root causes of poverty, of why they might be so desperate for that extra money every month.
It encourages people in a state of dependency. So it's just handing out payments directly from the government. And it doesn't do anything to address the structural costs that working families and poor people face every day, and specifically our regressive tax system.
What Guppy's essentially saying is that taxes and other costs brought on by the government take so much money out of our paychecks, and that it's just giving back this like Band-Aid of sorts, that these payments don't really address the root structural causes that make it so difficult for people to live.
There was another criticism that emerged, Monica, out of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that was this idea that the stimulus payments, so the federal government giving out 3 one-time payments over the course of the worst part of the pandemic, was a type of guaranteed basic income. And, you know, it did kind of act that way. A lot of people used this to help pay bills and other costs. But for many economists, long term, these payments have also been credited with increasing the inflation that we saw, you know, in recent years. And we're still really feeling the reverberations of in the economy. Did you hear anything about that, the idea of stimulus payments, UBI, being tied to inflation?
He definitely agreed that this kind of grand experiment with universal basic income that we did during the pandemic contributed to inflation. He did add that it was a bit of an extraordinary situation, which I think most economists would agree on, that it's more complicated than just money went out and inflation went up.
The unique thing about the COVID payments was that the crisis we were all living through was itself caused by government policy. So when the government passes a rule that says you're not allowed to go to work, you're not allowed to have income, then providing people with temporary support in the meantime makes sense. That still results in inflation, especially when the crisis is over.
We should note that there's still a lot of debate over how much relief payments contributed to inflation because there were so many other extraordinary circumstances in the economy at that time.
So this guaranteed basic income experiment in King County, this is a relatively small scale thing, just over 100 folks getting $500 a month. That comes out to about $51,000, which is not an insignificant cost, but nothing compared to what a broader county program or a statewide program would potentially look like. If this were to be rolled out more widely, Monica, where do advocates say funding would potentially come from?
They don't give specific funding sources as part of this report. The Workforce Development Council says that they are exploring scalable impacts of GPI, but this is more about a proof of concept of what this kind of money could do than a real policy recommendation of where the money could come from.
UBI is kind of hot right now. I mean, Stockton and Compton in California have run pilots. Baltimore has. There's been a number of these experiments in guaranteed basic income in recent years all over the country. In fact, there was a small UBI trial in South King County in 2022. What happened there, Monica? Were the results similar to what King County saw?
They were comparable. And, you know, this is similar to UBI pilots that have been done around the country. Typically, the outcomes are positive for participants and they're able to secure jobs, invest in their futures more. It's like we were talking about earlier, you know, when you're not spending every day just putting out fires, you can think a little bit more broadly about your long-term financial health.
Okay, so what's next for this? More piloting, a larger program in King County? I mean, any word from organizers about what they want the next steps to be now that they've crunched the numbers and looked at the data of the effect of these payments?
They're going to keep going with it. They actually already have two additional pilots underway with $500 payments and $1,000 payments. One thing that they found in the study was that families with young kids might need a larger amount to really move the needle. They're also planning a longer pilot to see what the impacts are when you provide this for more than 10 months. The other lasting impact is North Seattle College students who participated, like Rico. You know, they were very successful. That program saw full retention and completion rates, so the college is planning to continue monthly payments for selected students.
Monica Nicholsberg is the labor and economy reporter at KUOW. She's also the co-host of The Booming Podcast, which you can find anywhere you get your podcasts. And I'm really enjoying listening to Booming. And Monica, I just think this UBI idea is going to continue to be percolating, especially as we ask questions about how AI is going to be affecting the economy and employment levels. You know, all these things are going to be ongoing questions. So I'm glad that you're covering this and we'll keep following your reporting.
I'm glad to be covering it. And thank you for having me and listening to Booming.
As I mentioned, the idea for guaranteed or universal basic income has been tested before, typically through small-scale trials in cities looking at novel approaches to combat poverty. Tacoma's GRIT, Growing Resilience in Tacoma program, selected low-income single-parent households for support. Last year, California launched a program giving up to $1,200 a month with no spending restrictions to former foster youth in San Francisco and Ventura. A proposal for a state-funded basic income experiment failed to get out of committee in Washington's legislature this past session. Now, all of these trials I mentioned have been targeted at some of the neediest individuals in our society. The universal part of universal basic income has far fewer real-world models for testing. A notable exception? Alaska, where almost every resident gets a yearly check for thousands of dollars in many cases with no restrictions on how they spend the money. It's called the public fund dividend, and this injection of cash differs a bit every year based on the state's oil revenues. It typically hovers between $1,000 and $2,000, though in 2022 the payment popped up to more than $3,000. Over the years, it's become a significant feature of Alaska's economy and culture. But is it really universal basic income? And what can we learn from how people spend their Alaska PFD checks and what it means for the state's politics? Those questions are best asked to Brett Watson. Watson is an associate professor of applied and natural resource economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage and the Institute of Social and Economic Research. Hi, Brett. Thanks for being on Soundside today.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation, Libby.
So the Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend, it's been around since the 80s. For somebody that has never lived in Alaska, how does it work?
So the dividend has been around, like you said, since the early 80s. And the way that it works is that every year, the state of Alaska writes between a $2,000 and $3,000 check to everybody that lives in the state. Those checks get mailed out in early October every year. The amount can vary depending on what the price of oil is doing and how well our sovereign wealth fund or our permanent fund is doing. Last year, for example, a typical household in Alaska got about $10,000. So that was a pretty sizable dividend year in 2022. You have to be a resident of the state for the last calendar year and have to avoid certain criminal history with the state. But other than that, most people will get that check deposited in their bank account every year.
And are there any strings attached to that money, how it's used?
No. And in fact, because of the universality of the cash, there's both no formal restrictions and there's very little informal restrictions on how people use the money. People very much perceive this as just regular sources of their own income and feel a lot of freedom to spend the money however they see fit. Hmm. You know, around the time that the dividend gets paid out in October here, you see a lot of sale signs going up around town and you see a few more people crowd into some bars in town. And like I said, there's no stigma attached to that. People see this as their own money to do with as they see fit. There's very little judgment placed on people's neighbors for buying a new snow machine or taking that family vacation to Hawaii to get out a little bit during the cold winter here. People can use the money how they'd like to.
Wow. Is there a kind of a sense of a holiday or a celebration when the checks go out?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's actually something that I've studied a little bit in my own research. In a paper that we published a few years ago, we looked at how incidents of alcohol and drug abuse changed around the timing of the distribution. And, you know, that's often a concern that a lot of people have around these types of cash distributions, is that they'll be spent on so-called temptation goods or sort of socially unsavory things. And we do observe some of them. So we see kind of elevated uses of drugs and substances around the timing of these distributions. But, you know, when you look at it in kind of aggregate, you know, the amount of money that the state is distributing over the course of this year relative to the size of the state's economy, these effects are actually pretty small. So given the amount of money that's being distributed, the effects aren't large, but they're measurable. So we see that increase, we see this change, but from a social perspective, it's probably not the most concerning thing about the program.
Alaska's permanent fund dividend is often brought up as the best example we have in the United States as a large-scale example of universal basic income. Do you think that's a good comparison? Do you consider the PFD to be UBI?
Yes and no. So Alaska's dividend meets a few of the requirements that we might think of when we think about a universal basic income and kind of falls short in others. So we can start with that first word, universal. I think Alaska's dividend is certainly one of the best examples of a program that meets that criteria. We talked about the broad eligibility criteria that folks qualify for the dividend for. So lots of people get the cash in the state, and that's different than programs like the earned income tax credit, or even some of these basic income trials that have spun up in other places. On the other hand, we think about that word basic. What does it mean for an income to be basic, meet people's basic needs? As I said, sometimes the dividend amount is pretty significant. In 2022, the dividend amount was of almost $10,000 for a typical family in the state. But in other years, it's smaller than that. And we wouldn't think of an amount of about $5,000 per family per year as being enough to cover a family's basic needs. And so it might fall short of that definition of basic.
Is there any indication of how the money affects a family or an individual's health or well-being, having that little injection of cash every October?
Yeah, and that's something that we've studied in some of our research here. So we've looked at how child well-being is influenced by the receipt of the dividend, and we found increases in children's health from dividend receipt. And so we look at, you know, comparing years when the dividend is large compared to years when the dividend is small, and find that kids that are eligible to receive those big dividends tend to be a little bit healthier than kids that get smaller dividends, for example. And then we've also looked at a number of other dimensions related to health and well-being as well. And other researchers have done that and generally found positive effects of the cash in terms of families' well-being.
One of the chief concerns that a lot of opponents of the idea of universal basic income come up with is that the injection of money will disincentivize work. If people are able to just get money for nothing, they're going to be lazy. They're not going to get out there and try to find employment. Do you see any effect of the permanent fund dividend on employment in Alaska?
Yeah, that's a great question, Libby. And you're exactly right that this is one of the most common criticisms of these types of income support programs. So when we think about effects, I think it's important to think about two different ways in which we might see effects. One is at an individual level. So an individual is getting this cash, and that might change their incentive to work. But at the same time that an individual is getting cash in Alaska, everybody else is also getting cash in Alaska. And so a lot of people are running out to go participate in those PFD sales, for example. And that means retailers actually need to hire additional workers to help support that influx of customers. And so we have these kind of two countervailing effects. One is this individual, maybe personal disincentive to scale back on hours a little bit. And one is this more general broad-based economic stimulus effect of the cash. And so in our own research, we've looked at which of those two effects dominates. And actually, it depends on the type of person you are. So for men, we actually see an increase in their labor force participation rate. They're being hired to service this influx of customers that these businesses are receiving. But for women, and particularly mothers, of younger children, we see them scale back their participation in the labor force. Not a lot, but a little bit. But when we think about, you know, our concerns over the social potential ills of this cash, I think that mothers making additional investments in their younger children might be not particularly concerning from a social perspective. And in fact, it might be an additional benefit. There's a lot of research out there to suggest that additional maternal investment in children, particularly young children at early stages in their life, has big dividends in the long run for those children's outcomes. And so there again, even though the dividend might provide a disincentive effect in the labor force for this particular group, that actually might be a net positive from a broader social perspective.
Another criticism is the idea that this cash being put into the system will increase inflation. I know that's something that has been tracked to, for example, the extra unemployment benefits and stimulus checks that went out during the pandemic. Have you seen any effect of the permanent fund dividends, especially when they're higher, affecting inflation in Alaska?
Another great question. And honestly, this is probably the most important thing about the dividend that we don't have a lot of good data yet about. This problem is actually really complicated from a researcher's perspective to try to estimate. There's a lot of things that change in our economy in every given year. And like I said, the dividend amounts are related both to the price of oil, to the performance of our permanent fund, and most recently, to our state's budget health overall, which are also going to have really big impacts on what inflation is doing in the state. And so from a researcher's perspective, it's really hard to disentangle these things. But you're exactly right that there might be reasons to be concerned over what's going on in the price levels of the economy, not just the price of goods and services, but also the price of housing. And another thing that we might think is that the dividend might have an effect on wages. If employers, for example, that are trying to attract out-of-state talent for workers to come to Alaska, if they suggest that those workers can participate in this PFD program, that that acts as a bit of a subsidy to their wage rate, and employers might be able to offer a little bit less in terms of their wages in order to attract those workers up here. And so it might be the case that the dividend is just sort of subsidizing the wages for employers too.
So big picture, what I'm hearing from you is we maybe don't have as much information about inflation. We have a mixed picture on employment, but for men, it increases employment. For women, especially mothers, maybe they choose to spend more time at home. Overall, there are positive effects on the health and well-being of young kids in households that get these dividends. Any other effects that you want to highlight that you've seen from these checks that go out to most Alaskans?
One thing that I should mention is that the dividend is the most expensive thing, individual thing that the state of Alaska does. For a typical year, the state will spend about 20% of its budget on PFDs. So there's a large potential opportunity cost for that money. It's very much a debate over material issues. Should the government spend the next dollar that it has on a permanent fund dividend, or should we put that money into our public schools? That's a material difference for people, and it will have huge impacts on a lot of people's lives. Maybe one thing in sort of on the con list of the universality of the dividend. So when we think about different programs that the state might allocate resources to, when it allocates resources to the dividend program, 2/3 of the benefit of that program go to the highest 2/3 of income earners in the state. It's just definitionally true that most of the benefits of this program go to those with the most resources already. Whereas other programs like Medicaid expansion, for example, are more progressive, or food stamp payments or other income support payments. And I think that that's an important aspect of the dividend, too, is in terms of progressivity or regressivity, it's actually neutral. But we could think about allocating resources into programs that are more progressive. And that just has important distributional implications. But like I said, you trade those off against the potential stigma of participating in those programs, the administrative cost of trying to measure people's eligibility for these programs. It's expensive to send out social workers to homes to make sure that households don't have, high levels of assets or something that they're trying to hide. Very easy to administer the dividend program because, like I said, the eligibility requirements are so broad.
You know, in a lot of ways, no other states could really duplicate what Alaska has done here because it has to do with oil rights, mineral rights, this huge fund that was established in the 80s. There's not a lot of states that could replicate it. But do you think that there are lessons that other places could learn about, the ideas for UBI that have sort of gained in popularity since the Andrew Yang campaign in 2016 and, the Stockton experiments? Anything that you think other places could learn from what Alaska does?
So I think that, a couple of things come to mind right away. The first is, as I mentioned, in our experience, the fact that we pay dividends out to everybody has a much different implication than in these trials where you're talking about a relatively small group of people. Like I said, when you pay money out to everybody, it has the potential to generate these broader economic impacts, which has really important implications for something like labor force participation. So there are these general economic effects that can materialize when you pay cash to everybody. It also has the effect of destigmatizing the cash. Most people in Alaska participate in the dividend program, even though most people that are eligible for food stamps in Alaska don't participate in that program. And that's because there's some stigma around food stamps. Sometimes it's difficult to know if you qualify or how to qualify. Everybody knows how to fill out their annual PFD application, and they know to do it because everybody else is doing it at the same time. And then when it comes time to spend their PFD money, no stigma at the grocery store. You know, you can buy whatever you'd like to with it. And I think that that is an important lesson for other places, too, is to think about maybe those two dimensions, this eligibility dimension, the participation dimension, and then the stigma dimension.
Yeah, there's freedom and dignity in the idea that people don't look down on you for spending the money. It's fascinating stuff. Brett Watson, an associate professor of applied and natural resource economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage and with the Institute of Social and Economic Research. Thank you very much for the conversation. It's been really fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, great to be with you, Libby.
And we also asked you if you've ever experienced the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, if you lived in Alaska at one point in your life. Nicole wrote in with her story. She says, my family and everyone we knew really relied on the Permanent Fund dividend to help fill in financial gaps and mend whatever had broken throughout the year. October was when we caught up on late utility bills, repaired broken down cars, or bought another less broken down car, and stocked up on essentials like propane and dog food. Melissa says, as a family of five with only my father working, the dividends allowed us to take a family vacation, usually a road trip to the lower 48 to visit family, and provided some extra money for Christmas. Annette Promise, KUOW's chief marketing officer, slacked me with her story. She actually got the very first Alaska Permanent Fund dividend payout in 1982. She says, my mom wouldn't let my brother and I use it on a consumable thing, so I spent mine on a stereo and a bedroom furniture set from the Sears catalog. She ended up keeping that when she moved to Washington finally, and she thinks of it as a really fun story. She kept the bedroom set until she left home for college. Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's Teen Dance Ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.